This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last weekend, pharmaceutical giant Pfizer pulled the plug on its most promising new drug, a heart disease medicine called torcetrapib. The decision came after clinical trials made it clear that instead of decreasing deaths, the drug did the opposite. Torcetrapib is in a new category of drugs that gave hope to people with heart disease. Statins, like Pfizer's best-selling Lipitor, do a good job lowering LDL, the so-called bad cholesterol, but even so, heart disease remains our biggest killer. This new drug increases the level of HDL, good cholesterol, which is believed to reduce the size of plaques in the heart's arteries and then lower the risk of heart attack. And there are major financial implications, too. To begin with, Pfizer had to write off $1 billion in development as a total loss, and the new drug had been expected to become its next blockbuster. To make matters worse, patent protection of some of the company's big sellers expires over the next few years. The failure of new heart treatments has many concerned about improving the treatment of heart disease and about the health of the pharmaceutical industry. Later this hour, why spam continues to defeat the best effort of junk mail email blockers. But first, the recent heart drug failure. If you have questions about what works and what doesn't, or about profits and drug development, join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email talk@npr.org. Joanne Silberner is NPR's health policy correspondent. She joins us here in Studio 3. Always nice to have you on the program, Joanne.
Thank you, Neil.
So, less than a week ago, Pfizer's chief executive, Jeffrey Kindler, was saying publicly that this drug could be among the most important new developments for heart disease in decades, and that the company was going to be pressing for FDA approval in 2007. So what happened?
Well, what happened was there's a data safety monitoring board that looks at how people are doing on this drug, and they discovered, I think it was on Friday, that there were more deaths in the, as you mentioned, in the group taking the drug. Now, that's not what you want to see.
No.
So the drug is gone.
One of the first questions I guess we have to ask, obviously, the drug Vioxx, an anti-arthritic drug, did not work as advertised. It caused deaths, and the company that manufactured it is now in a series of lawsuits. That same sort of thing going to happen to Pfizer after this clinical trial?
Probably not. Just to be in a trial, you have to sign something saying you understand that you're taking a risk. The patients are generally very well informed. Unless something went very wrong with that process, and it's not likely, they knew that they were taking an experimental drug. There was every reason to think that this was a good drug. Clinically, or experimentally rather, they know it raises HDL. That should be a good thing.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the question that a lot of people are asking now is this particular drug and the specific way it improves HDL, or is it the whole family of drugs? And Pfizer's not the only company developing them. Is it the whole family of drugs that seek to boost HDL?
That's an extremely important question. Pfizer actually has a couple of other drugs that are very similar to this one coming up. You know, everyone criticizes drug companies for developing what they call me-too drugs, but sometimes it's just one drug in a family that has a problem. Sometimes it's what they call a class effect, all the drugs. Pfizer's got to go back now, and researchers will go back now and look and see what was the cause of death in these people, try and figure out, is it this molecule? Is it all molecules like it? It could be that the class is not dead. It could be that similar drugs do well. It could be there's a way to mitigate whatever it is that's causing the problems. We'll have to wait and see on that one.
Now, obviously, this is a major disappointment for Pfizer. We'll talk about more about that later. But a disappointment as well for people with heart disease.
Absolutely. As Dr. Nissen, who's sitting next to me, will say a little later, I think people die while on statins. Statins fewer people die, but some people do. They're not the be-all and end-all. They're not enough. There are close to 1 million heart attacks in this country every year. HDL looks good. You know, when you look at people who have naturally high levels of HDL, they tend to do better. So, you know, if they can recreate that and if they do better, that could be a big help.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get to Dr. Nissen in just a moment. But we need to point out that heart disease is not only the leading killer of men in this country, it's the leading killer of women, too.
Absolutely. You know, for years, that was, especially in the 50s and 60s, it used to be this was a disease of men. The American Heart Association reluctantly admits to having hosted something back in the 60s for women across the country, how to help your husband. Now, it happens to women, too. It tends to happen a little bit when they're a little bit older, But it does, and as you said, it is the leading cause of death for women too. So that's in the last few years, people have really brought that idea along. There's legislation in Congress to try and promote that, and I think that's something that, I mean, women need to listen to this just as much as men do.
Well, let's turn now to Dr. Nissen, Steve Nissen, chairman of cardiovascular medicine at the Cleveland Clinic, and one of the lead investigators of an earlier torcetrapib clinical trial, and he's with us here in Studio 3. Nice to have you on the program today.
Great to be here.
And what happened?
Well, of course, we don't know everything about what happened. When a data safety and monitoring board stops a trial because of excess mortality, often the actual causes of death have not been adjudicated. They haven't been looked at closely enough. And over the next several months, there'll be an opportunity to look more deeply into the data. In addition, there are other trials that have been going on in parallel. Now, all research with this drug, torcetrapib, has been stopped. But I had already completed a study where we used tiny ultrasound probes to measure the buildup of plaque in the coronary arteries and to look at the effect of the drug on top of the statin drugs that have been so successful. Since that trial is completed, we were in the cleanup phase, and in early January, we'll actually get a look at the data. This will be an important clue as to whether or not it is a class effect or whether something specific to torcetrapib. We may find, and this may surprise you, but we may find that the drug was actually promoting the progression of atherosclerosis, of the plaque buildup in coronary arteries. And if that's the case, then it's probably going to be the same problem with other drugs in the class, and we may have to look elsewhere at other ways to raise HDL that might benefit patients.
And other drugs that might raise HDL, there are other ways to raise HDL.
There are. We have some that are clinically available. One of them is the vitamin niacin. It can be taken in very large doses. It does work, although it doesn't produce as much HDL raising. What had us so excited about torcetrapib is that we were seeing 50% increases in HDL. That's a really big increase. And if you look at that and you look at something like the Framingham study where we followed patients, a 50% increase in HDL would be an enormous decrease in the risk of heart attack and stroke if it actually was good HDL. A niacin, perhaps 20 or 25% increases. And the problem there is that there are a certain number of patients that get flushing or itching of the skin. And so we just can't treat everybody with niacin. We don't get enough effect from it, and not everybody can take it.
And I gather some drugs are in development that would reduce the flushing effect, which I gather drives people absolutely nuts.
Well, you know, it's funny. We see people who just aren't bothered by it. You know, they say, well, it's sort of a warm sensation, and they kind of get used to it. And after a period of time, they tolerate it very well. But side effects for drugs are very individualized. What will be okay for one person would be just intolerable for the next person. So we have limits on what we can do with HDL, and that's why everybody was so excited about this.
And obviously, a diet and exercise can affect your HDL as well.
They can, although it's not as much as we would like. You know, first of all, everybody listening should understand that a proper diet and lots of exercise ought to be the mainstay for all of us. But you can only raise HDL 5 or 10% with these interventions. And, you know, if you're a patient whose HDL is really low, then we're going to need to have drugs to raise it if we want to be able to further reduce this terrible burden of disease.
Let's see if we can get some listeners in on the conversation. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And let's begin with John. John's with us from San Jose, California.
Hi, thank you. I was watching CNBC when the Pfizer CEO was on when this news came out and was absolutely astounded to find out that over 80 people died during this trial. And my question is, how many people would have died and they found it acceptable and brought the drug to market? What was the benchmark on deaths? Just astounding that this would happen. So just interesting, be interested to get your comments on that.
Joanne Silberner, can you put that into context for us?
I think I can put it into numbers context, and I think Dr. Nissen can put it into statistical context, that the 82 people, it was 81 or 82 people, 82 people out of a group of 7,500 people. In the other group, there were 51 deaths. So it's not like 82 is from zero. It's 82 from 51. But I think for the statistical reasoning, let's ask Dr. Nissen.
Well, doing a clinical trial is not easy. And the goal, of course, is to bring new medicines forward. And in doing that, there are a number of ethical standards that have to be applied. And one of them is to have a group that's outside of the pharmaceutical company and outside of the trial investigators that's watching. And that's called a data safety and monitoring board. This one was chaired by a very experienced man who's done this for many years and who has I have a lot of confidence in him. And so they're looking at the data, and they know who got which drug. They know who got the sugar pill.
And Pfizer doesn't.
And Pfizer doesn't. Pfizer didn't make this decision. This decision was made by independent, very, very strong physician scientists. And what has to happen in order to make a good decision is you have to wait until there's statistical evidence either of benefit or of harm. And this board could have stopped the trial if there had been strong evidence of benefit. They would have said, listen, these patients that are getting the drug are dying at a fewer frequency, and therefore it's no longer ethical to continue the trial. We have to stop it. And we would have all celebrated, of course, that we would have a new medication. So this is a risky business. There are ways of doing it. I will reassure the listeners here that everything in this trial, I believe, by the investigators, and I was not one of them, but the people who did this trial handled it exactly correctly. They stopped the trial when they should have.
And they, as I understand it, called Pfizer and said, we have a problem here, and it was just a few hours later that Pfizer pulled the plug.
I mean, they had the entire program shut down worldwide within 24 hours, and they made a public announcement. And I think we expect that kind of transparency. That's the right thing to do. And we should really, you know, I've been somebody to criticize the industry on many occasions. But when they do things right, we ought to compliment them.
John, thanks very much for the call. We're talking about the recent failure of Pfizer's new drug, a treatment for heart disease, and about what's next for drug makers and other new treatments. You can join the conversation if you'd like. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after a short break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about heart disease, the ongoing search for new drugs, and what the failure of one of Pfizer's most promising new treatments means for patients. We're talking about what all this means for the drug companies, too, in just a few minutes. Right now, our guests are Joanne Silberner, NPR health policy correspondent, also Dr. Steve Nissen, chairman of the cardiovascular medicine at the Cleveland Clinic, and who was a lead investigator in an earlier study of torcetrapib, the clinical trials. And, of course, we welcome you in the conversation. If you have questions about what works and what doesn't, or about profits and drug development, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's turn to Pam. Pam's with us from Aberdeen, Idaho.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, I have a question for Dr. Nissen, actually. I used to work for a crop protection product manufacturer, and I know that there's a lot of steps that you have to go through during the discovery phase, and as the product moves through those steps, if there's any problem that shows up, then, you know, it's weeded out, basically, and they drop it before it gets to a major stage where it costs a lot of money. So why didn't they, you know, catch any problems with this drug, the Pfizer drug, you know, earlier in, you know, in that discovery and development process?
Well, it's very challenging to know when those risks are going to appear. In fact, a lot of drugs have actually gotten to market and ultimately have found to have risks we didn't anticipate and had to be withdrawn. It turns out that if something happens with a relatively low frequency, until you expose large numbers of patients, you simply can't get the statistical evidence you need to know that the drug is actually producing harm. We have three phases of clinical trial development for new drug development: phase one, phase two, and phase three. In phase one and phase two, we're often talking about a few hundred patients that have gotten the drug. And so seeing a mortality disadvantage or even a disadvantage in terms of heart attacks is just not going to show up until you start to expose large numbers of patients. This study that was stopped prematurely was involving 15,000 patients. And remember that out of those 15,000 patients, there were 31 excess deaths, and that was enough to provide the statistical evidence to shut down the program.
Hmm. Pam, thanks.
Yeah, all right. Thanks.
Appreciate it. Let's turn now to, this is Brian. Brian's with us from OMAC in Washington.
Well, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
My question is, a couple months back on Diane Rehm's show, actually, they had one of the top physicians, and he was saying that, and he was one of the ones that started the research into the anti-cholesterol drugs, was that if you take that plaque off the walls, the interior plaque can explode and actually cause more damage. And he was telling people maybe they shouldn't be taking these anti-cholesterol drugs.
Like Lipitor, the statin drug. So, Dr. Nissen, I think this is to you.
Well, we've been studying these drugs now since 1987 when the first statin drug was first introduced. And we've never seen any evidence that reducing cholesterol and making the plaque smaller would actually harm people. And I'm not sure quite who was there or what they were saying, but the bottom line is that it's great that we have cholesterol-lowering drugs like the statins, but you know, it's not enough. You know, they reduce the risk of heart attack and stroke by perhaps about a third. And I've said actually several times that if we put statin drugs in the water supply, that cardiovascular disease would still be the leading cause of death in most Western countries. This was an effort, the development of torcetrapib, to get beyond the statin paradigm. It failed, but we're going to keep trying because we must. We have a disease that ultimately will kill up to 50% of the population in Western countries. If you live long enough, you're likely to die of heart disease. We've got to find new drugs. It's getting tougher and tougher.
Mm-hmm. Brian, thanks very much.
Well, thank you. Have a wonderful Christmas season.
You too. Bye-bye. Let's go now to Brian. To Charles. Charles in Walla Walla, Washington.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Good afternoon here.
Oh, yes, sir. I've taken niacin for decades and find it to be very successful. It has dramatically reduced my poor cholesterol, and it is so cheap. I think that's why we don't hear enough about it.
And do you suffer from those flashes that we were talking about earlier?
You learn to tolerate them.
And that's the experience, I gather, you know, just hang in there for a couple of months and people learn to tolerate the flashes, Dr. Nissen.
A month,
okay.
Yeah. Well, this is the key to using niacin. And niacin,
I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Charles. Yeah. Thanks very much.
Yeah. Niacin is very inexpensive, which, of course, is a huge advantage, and it does raise HDL modestly. It also lowers LDL a little bit, the bad cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very good drug. And the way cardiologists tend to use it is that we will start with a very low dose and we'll inch our way up. What I actually often do is take as long as 6 months to get people up to full doses. And if I do that, I find they adjust to each level of increase, and I can get perhaps two-thirds of patients to be able to tolerate it. But I can't get to the full dose. The maximum dose that you really want to get to is 2,500 milligrams a day. And you just can't get most people up there. They start to get this intolerable, you know, hot flashes, and you know, they say it's enough. And so we get 1,500 milligrams, sometimes 2,000, but it's a tough drug to use for some people. There's no question that a motivated patient can often overcome the limitations of the drug. And that's an important, you know, message, is this a partnership between physicians and their patients. And if patients understand the benefits, then often they're willing to put up with the nuisances.
Let's turn to Tom. Tom's with us from Cincinnati.
Good afternoon, Neil.
Afternoon.
A comment and then a question. I think the amount of money that Pfizer spent, I've heard and reported upwards of $800 million, and now pulling the drug and basically shelving it does point out the tremendous risk that's inherent within the pharmaceutical industry. And in many cases, I believe more often than not, these promising molecules don't pan out and never make it to market. So I think it partially explains some of the costs that we all tend to complain about. And then secondly, I'd be curious to get any other agents. I have heard that there's a synthetic molecule being developed, the Milano ApoA1, that supposedly may be promising. Was curious to see if Dr. Nissen had any updates or any news on where that stands.
The rest of us think Milanos are cookies.
Yeah.
So we're going to turn this over to Dr. Nissen.
Well, it just so happens by chance that this was a study that I conducted and reported in late 2003. And to make a long story short, we took and made a synthetic HDL particle based upon a protein obtained from some individuals in Italy near the city of Milan. And we were very surprised when we gave this intravenously, gave five doses over 5 weeks, and saw some pretty remarkable regression, meaning reduction in the burden of plaque in their coronaries. It turns out, however, there are many obstacles to its development. It's very hard to make. The little company that developed it was actually purchased by Pfizer. So this is actually another Pfizer product. And maybe we'll turn some more attention to trying to figure out how to get around the obstacles to development of that drug. But, you know, we're not going to quit. The fact that one drug failed doesn't mean that we're going to give up on the idea of raising the good cholesterol. And one of the reasons why everybody was so excited about torcetrapib was the results of the ApoA1 Milano study, which showed such dramatic and rapid benefits. But we're going to get back on the horse, and we'll find another way to do this.
Tom, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
The failure of torcetrapib was not just a health story, but a big business story as well. NPR's Snigdha Prakash covers the pharmaceutical industry, and she's also joined us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on the program, Snigdha.
Thank you, Neil.
So how big a problem is this for Pfizer? We're hearing that initial write-off was as big as $1 billion.
That's right. And there are many ways to quantify how big it is. And no matter how you slice and dice it, it's very, very big. One way that analysts, of course, have been thinking about it was that the role of torcetrapib in Pfizer's business scheme was to replace revenues from Lipitor, the statin that we've been hearing about, which is not just Pfizer's best-selling drug, but the world's best-selling drug, with annual sales, I believe, this year expected to be $13 billion. Lipitor goes off patent in 2011. That means that generic versions of Lipitor will flood the market, and the profits from Lipitor will pretty much dry up. And Pfizer was hoping that torcetrapib would be the successor to Lipitor, and of course, now it's not there.
Mm-hmm. So they've got a huge hole in their sort of drug portfolio. And as I understand it, not an awful lot in the pipeline coming through.
That's right. There is a big gaping hole. One analyst I spoke to has put it very dramatically. She said that they are not expecting what they call organic growth, growth from within Pfizer, for 10 years. That's a long time.
And this is the world's biggest pharmaceutical company.
It's the biggest pharmaceutical company, and though not every pharmaceutical company is exactly like Pfizer, it is fair to say that as Pfizer goes, so does a lot of the industry.
So this is characteristic of other drug companies, too?
Right. So here's the structural problem. Drug makers now rely on very, very big drugs. They call them blockbuster drugs, which sell literally at the rate of billions of dollars a year. They have patents, that means the exclusive right to sell them for, well, in the U.S. by law, 20 years, though in practice it's usually a bit less. When the drugs go off patent, the profits evaporate, and drug makers rely on finding new drugs to replace those drugs. We happen to be going through a period which is sort of like, you know, a cyclical drought. And there are a couple of problems here in terms of finding new drugs. One is that there are really big shoes to fill. You know, if Lipitor is a $13 billion drug, it's not easy to find another drug that will generate $13 billion in sales. And the other one is that we've got some really good drugs. It's not easy to find a drug that's better than Lipitor, as Dr. Nissen has been telling us.
Yet I also read that we should not necessarily be weeping for the pharmaceutical industry, that Pfizer in particular is still very profitable.
Yes, don't pull out the hankies just yet. I wouldn't weep. It is a very profitable company. However, on Wall Street, for drug makers, as with every other company, what matters is growth. And the minute you say that there's going to be no growth, investors don't like that. Pfizer, in fact, by Monday night, had lost almost 12% or $20 billion of its share value. Just gone.
Now, how is the industry responding to this?
Well, the drug industry is, if anything, a flexible, resilient kind of place. They've got all kinds of strategies. So let me reel off a few that I've been hearing from people. One, of course, is acquisitions. You know, you can, if you're not developing your own drugs, you go out and you buy companies.
You
that
can
are,
buy those Milanos. Yeah,
you buy Milanos, exactly. They're thinking of buying biotech companies, but, you know, drug development is risky everywhere. In some cases, they are diversifying into medical devices.
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow, as you may know, there is a big FDA panel on something called stents, which are used to open up clogged arteries. A drug maker named Abbott had bought a huge device maker called Guidant, which makes these drug-eluting stents. They open up and keep open your arteries.
And then they're soaked in drugs to help them do this.
Exactly, but there are safety problems. So suddenly, you know, this is not a foolproof strategy either, to diversify out of drugs into medical devices. They're cutting costs. Pfizer just told us last week that they're cutting 20% of their sales force. They are doing a lot of heavy-duty lobbying here in Washington to make sure the government doesn't get into setting prices for Medicare drugs or negotiating with drug makers. So they have a few things up their sleeves, and they are doing research. They are doing a lot of research as well.
Snigdha Prakash, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil.
NPR's Snigdha Prakash covers the pharmaceutical industry. She joined us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get some more phone calls on this story. And let's go to, this is Emmy. Emmy in Stony Brook, New York.
Hi.
Hi.
So my question for the Dr. Nissen is that a good part of objectivity in reporting any opinion on a drug company is usually reporting your conflicts of interest. And I was wondering if you could tell us what conflicts of interest you have, meaning what investment do you have in the pharmaceutical company, and what portion of your work do they have funding towards?
Yeah. Well, of course, I'm very sensitive to these issues. And many years ago, I recognized, as I think many people in America have, that there are problems with conflict of interest with physicians who are involved in research. And so I adopted as a personal approach that I would not accept honorary consulting fees of any kind from anybody in the pharmaceutical or device industry. Instead, I donate these to a charity, in this case, the American College of Cardiology, an organization that's really dedicated to promoting heart health. And I think that more and more physicians are beginning to realize that the conflict of interest problem is an important one. And I was hoping in doing that, that I would actually encourage others to also adopt the same policy, which is to say we should be involved in research and in things that benefit patients, but our personal reimbursement for it doesn't make a lot of sense, and it does create a conflict of interest. And so I've said I'm not going to do that.
Thank you. I'm actually a medical student at Stony Brook University, and this is a very heated topic of discussion, and I'm really glad that you did take that route.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Emmy, and good luck with your studies.
Thank you.
Let's see if we get one last call in. This is Steven. Steven with us from San Francisco.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I have been checking my cholesterol every year for the last 10 or 15 years, and my good cholesterol, HDL, always used to be right around the lower limit of mm-hmm. the recommended dose or slightly below it, meaning it was always very low. And over the last 4 years or so, I started taking high doses of fish oil and flaxseed oil. I take about 3,000 milligrams of fish oil, 2,000 milligrams of flaxseed oil every day. and the results have been astounding. My HDL has actually shot up by about 70%.
Is that a course of action you would recommend, Dr. Nissen?
It can work in some people. And one of the problems, however, with fish oil is that it's not a standardized preparation. No, it's part of what we call nutraceuticals. And we have a problem in America in that these dietary supplements are not allowed by law to be regulated by the FDA. Terrible mistake that was made in 1994 was to take these supplements and move them out of the control of the FDA.
Supplement industry doesn't agree with you.
Well, yeah, they don't agree with me, but I feel very strongly about this. And so it turns out there now is actually a biopharmaceutical, which is a standardized, highly concentrated form of fish oil. And research is showing that in certain people with high triglyceride levels, you could lower the triglycerides and raise the HDL successfully, at least in some people.
Stephen, thanks very much, and I'm glad it works for you.
Thank you.
And Dr. Nissen, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it. Steve Nissen is chairman of the cardiovascular medicine at the Cleveland Clinic and a lead investigator of an earlier clinical trial of torcetrapib. We'd also like to thank Joanne Silberner, NPR's health policy correspondent. Both of them were with us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, stop deleting all those junk emails for a minute. We'll talk about spam and why we can't seem to stop it. Tell us what you've done to try to stop unwanted emails. Has it worked? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.